Hey everybody, it's Brock Falk, and I want to thank you for listening to this message from Heritage Church of Christ. We would be thrilled to share more content like this with you and make it easy for you to share it with others. You can find more messages like this on our podcast, or you can download our smartphone app by searching for Heritage Church of Christ in your app store. But most importantly, I hope this message encourages you to take a next step toward a thriving relationship with Jesus. Enjoy.
Well, over the last couple of weeks, as the 2010s came to a close, and this new decade called the 2020s, I know there's some discrepancy about when a decade starts, but I'm going with it, all right? When the 20s started this past week, there were magazines and news articles all over the place that were sprinkled with headlines and articles about things like 2019 in review, or the most memorable and significant happenings of the decade that was the 2010s. And it's pretty amazing when you think about it how much different the world really is now. I mean, a decade ago, it was most of us had a Blockbuster video card in our wallet. If you were really advanced, you had a Netflix subscription and they mailed DVDs to your house. Some of you don't even remember that. A decade ago, if you had a smartphone, which is kind of unlikely, it probably had an actual physical keyboard with all 26 letters of the alphabet on it. Maybe it was a Palm Pilot. Maybe you had one of those cool business phones, you know, that made you look really important. It probably didn't have any apps on it, though, because those hardly existed. A decade ago, nobody had ever heard of Instagram or Uber or Pinterest or, can you get this, Alexa. Nobody had heard of Alexa. What would you do now without Alexa in your life? So there's been a lot that's changed. And it's pretty normal at a time like this, at the end of a year or the beginning of a new one, especially at the beginning of a new decade, it's pretty normal to reflect on everything that's happened in the time that's just gone by. But it's not just in the news and it's not just on a macro scale. I've been enjoying over the last week or two watching as friends of mine on my social networks have been looking back at where their own lives have taken them over the past year or the past 10. I've got some friends who are celebrating major milestones and victories that have happened in their lives, and I've got other friends who are saying goodbye and good riddance to 2019 and to the 2010s, and they are hoping that the 2020s are going to be a whole lot different. We can all kind of look back on the past year and the past decade and think, well, there are some times I'd like to relive again. There's some times I'd like to have another chance to do that better. There's some times that were just absolutely incredible and some times that I wasn't sure I would make it through. But the truth is that every single one of us can look back on our own past and remember moments that we're proud of and moments that we just as soon forget, right? Later this month, I'm anticipating the series finale of a show I've been watching called The Good Place. Anybody in the room familiar with this show? In case you haven't heard about it, I won't spoil the whole thing, but it's about four humans who die and then find themselves resurrected in a pleasant, carefree afterlife neighborhood called The Good Place. It's the kind of place where you can fly and eat ice cream that tastes like your dreams and meet your soulmate, you know, and do all of that like within just the span of a few hours and have eternity to enjoy the whole thing. The only problem is two of those four humans quickly begin to realize that there must be a problem because they remember that they lived very selfish, immoral lives when they were on earth, and they're thinking, there's no way. There's no way I got into the good place. There's got to be some mistake. And they believe an error has been made, a clerical error somewhere along the way. Now, this show's not based on the Christian faith, but it plays off of a misunderstanding that's common to Christians and a misunderstanding, in fact, a myth that lots of humans in general believe. The myth is that your behavior will determine where you spend eternity. This entire show is based on this misconception, this misunderstanding, this false assumption that the sum total of each person's actions constitutes a running tab of positives and negatives in the grand score column of your life. It's like a credit score or a driving record, only a whole lot more is at stake. And so the assumption is that we're recording pluses and minuses, and in the end, the big question is, did the pluses outnumber or outweigh the minuses by a large enough margin? And so a typical approach to life throughout human history, a typical approach to trying to prepare for whatever comes next, has been to strategically try to make sure that the positives outweigh the negatives, that the pluses outweigh the minuses. And it's funny, the little games you can play in your head over stuff like this, right? Because you can think to yourself, hey, I left a really good tip for the waitress. That's like a big plus. But then like just a few minutes later, you're like, I dropped my gum wrapper on the ground and I didn't pick it up. Minus one. Or you think to yourself, hey, I get a lot of positive points because I helped set up my grandma's new cell phone. That's big points, right? But at the same time, I taught her how to send group text messages. That's major negative points. That's the kind of behavioral accounting system that they're using on The Good Place. And it seems so logical because that's the way that most of the rest of life seems to work. But I want to tell you some good news this morning. I want to tell you some good news that the gospel of Jesus contradicts that system and makes that behavioral scoring system obsolete. The good news that Jesus offers to the world is that your pluses and your minuses are actually never going to be enough. They're never going to be adequate. And so Jesus has changed the game. And this morning I want to walk through one of the passages in the New Testament. In fact, it's probably a passage that many of you have heard before. A passage from the New Testament portion of your Bible that frequently gets mistaken to be evidence that God is a scorekeeping God. And so this morning we're going to start in the book of Matthew. It's the very first book in the New Testament portion of your Bible. Of course, you can find it in alphabetical order on the Bible app on your phone. But when you get there, we're in Matthew chapter 25. And this comes at the end of a series of teachings from Jesus about judgment and about the eventual return of the Lord. Now, some of that sounds intimidating and confusing to begin with. You should know that this entire section, in fact, depending on your Bible, chapters 23 through 25 are probably written entirely in red ink, which signifies that these are all words of Jesus. So it's like supposedly a long diatribe, a long series of teaching, kind of a lecture from Jesus. And this section of Matthew, it is complicated. It's got lots of insider language that's based on the Hebrew scriptures from the Old Testament. It's got references that honestly just would have made a whole lot more sense to the first century Jewish audience that Jesus was speaking to than it might to a 21st century audience like us. But in chapter 25, beginning in verse 31, Jesus uses real plain language to describe a coming day of judgment. Here's what he says. Verses 31 through 33, when the Son of Man comes, now that's Jesus referring to himself with some Old Testament language, with an Old Testament title from way back from the prophets, 400, 500, 600 years before he spoke these words. When the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, he will sit on his glorious throne, and all the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate the people from one another the way a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. I didn't realize this. I had to learn it in my research this week, that shepherds would keep sheep and goats together during the day. But because the goats were not as tolerant of the climate, they would have to separate them and take them inside at night. But the sheep could stay out. And so they'd have to separate them every day. This is what Jesus says the Son of Man will separate the people from all the nations as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And he will put the sheep on his right and put the goats on his left. And this is a metaphor, but it's this vivid depiction, this vivid description of this coming day of judgment. And Jesus refers to himself in the place of this king, this Son of Man that's going to come back. And the passage continues like this. It says, "Then the king will say to those on his right," which are the sheep, "Come, you who are blessed by my Father, take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world." So he's promising them this reward that they have coming. But I wanted you to notice the tense. I wanted you to notice that he doesn't talk about blessing in terms of something that's going to happen. He doesn't talk to them about blessing in terms of something that's coming in the future. He doesn't say, "You who are going to be blessed by my Father." What did he say? "You who are blessed." It's in the present tense. He's talking to people who are already experiencing, already living into, already having received a blessing. And the king describes these blessed people this way. He says, "I was hungry and you fed me. I was thirsty and you gave me a drink. I was a stranger and you invited me into your house, your home. I was naked and you gave me clothing. I was sick and you cared for me. I was in prison and you visited me." Jesus describes all of these ways that these people helped him. And he says, these are the people who are blessed. The thing that blessed people have in common is that they're helpers. The thing that blessed people in this scenario, in this story, have in common is that they helped Jesus. But the funny thing is, these people sound really surprised. Their response, and that we're going to read in just a second, their response to Jesus' statement about all of the ways that they had helped him, they're in shock. They can't remember any of these situations. They're surprised. They remember helping people, but they're surprised to learn that they helped the king. In fact, they'll ask him, they say, "Lord, when did we ever see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and show you hospitality? When did we see you naked and give you clothing? When did we ever see you sick or in prison and visit you?" Because these people that the king says are blessed are also confused. They're confused, blessed people, because they don't ever remember seeing the king in need. In fact, kings aren't usually in need. If you see a king in need, something serious has happened, right? If you see a king that's in need, chances are that they have been relieved of their kingship, or they're just about to be. But the king addresses their confusion with this explanation in verse 40. He says, "I tell you the truth, when you did it to one of the least of these my brothers and sisters, you were doing it for me." Not directly to me. You didn't actually put clothes on the naked king. You didn't actually give a cup of water to the thirsty king. But he says, every time you helped somebody who really needed it, every time you helped somebody who was actually suffering, it was just the same thing as if I had been standing right there. It was the same thing as if you did it directly to me. When you helped somebody who couldn't help themselves, when you came to the aid of somebody who was suffering, when you visited somebody who was lonely, it's like you were offering that help directly to me. And these people have no recollection. They don't have any recollection of helping the king personally. They helped needy people, but they never considered it a gift directly to Jesus. They just thought they were helping people. They just thought they were being generous. They just thought they were being neighborly. They just thought they were doing what you ought to do. They just thought they were doing something kind. They just thought that they were doing the right thing, and what was coming out of their heart Now hold that thought there for a second, because we're going to come back to it after we read the rest of the passage, but I want you to see how the rest of this conversation goes. Jesus says, "Then the king will turn to those on the left," these are the goats, "and say, 'Away with you, you cursed ones, into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his demons.'" We're getting serious now. And again, he doesn't say, "You people who are about to be cursed." Although it kind of sounds like the next step doesn't sound good, right? He doesn't say that, though. He says, "You who are cursed. You who are already experiencing the curse." And his explanation sounds a little familiar. He says, "Because I was hungry and you didn't feed me. I was thirsty and you didn't give me something to drink," etc., etc. All of the same examples, except these people didn't show up. These people didn't do anything. He describes all of the times that they looked right past him. And their response is just as surprised. There's a little more panic in their voice about it, of course, but they're just as surprised as the first group. In fact, they object. Verse 44, "Lord, when did we ever see you hungry? When did we ever see you thirsty or naked or sick or in prison or a stranger not help you? Because if we had seen you, we would have helped." I mean, we're not crazy. If we had seen the king needing something, suffering, lonely, struggling, we would have stepped up to the plate. If we had realized that the king was in need, we would have done something about it. And some of them might have done it out of allegiance because they thought that's what servants of the king ought to do. And some of them might have done something out of a sense of duty. Like, I don't know, I owe it to him. Some of them might have done this as a strategic move to get in good with the king. I mean, if somebody way above you on the rungs of social power needs something from somebody in your lowly position and you can do it, then, you pass that favor up and hope they remember that. Any one of these people who knew that the king needed help would have stepped up to fill it if they'd only known. There was a show that was popular a few years back called Undercover Boss, and it followed these company executives who would dress up in disguise and then pose as lower level workers, hourly workers in their own company, to kind of get a sense of how things were going and what morale was like at the ground level and what it was like to work for the company that they were leading. And so there was this episode where an executive from Boston Market, the chief brand officer, disguised herself and went to work in one of the restaurants where she learned processes for preparing the food and discovered inefficiencies, and she interacted with customers and staff. But unfortunately, she interacted with this one staff member named Ronnie. Some of you are shaking your heads because you've seen this episode. And Ronnie was not a happy camper. Ronnie was so put out with all of the customers who came in the door. He felt like all of the customers were so needy and stupid and really just were a waste of his time. And so he would talk bad about the customers behind their backs when they weren't around, and he would treat them with disdain at the service counter when they were face to face. And it finally got so bad in the course of the show that the executive broke character and revealed to Ronnie who she was. And she reprimanded him in front of his peers there in the back of the restaurant. And then she pulled rank and forced the manager to fire Ronnie on the spot. And he seemed so surprised. Like, "Man, you really got me. I had no idea that you were the chief brand officer." You know, like he didn't understand. It worked. The disguise worked on him. He didn't understand exactly who it was he was speaking to and working with. And you have to assume that if he had known, if he had understood, if she was wearing a name tag that said, "I outrank you by about 55 levels, that he probably would have saved that conversation to talk to somebody else. That he probably would have behaved differently. But see, that's part of the problem. Because Boston Market isn't trying to train employees who will toe the line and put their best foot forward for the executives. Boston Market wants to employ people who think everybody in the restaurant is important. They want to employ people who want to serve the customer well and speak well about the customer, even when the executives are not in the room. Which brings us back to our passage in Matthew. Because after these cursed people reveal their surprise because they don't remember ever seeing the king in need, the king says, I tell you the truth, when you refused to help the least of my brothers and sisters, when you refused to help whoever it was that you saw that was suffering, struggling, lonely, vulnerable, thirsty, all of those other things he listed, you were refusing to help me. He says it's the same thing as if I was the one who was there in need. Your refusal to help them had nothing to do with their circumstance and everything to do with your heart. And it revealed that your heart is cursed. You see, the cursed people, they didn't help the king, but only because they just didn't realize it was him. They thought they were neglecting somebody else. They thought they were passing by somebody inconsequential. They thought they were ignoring some needy person whose plight would have no effect on their own personal circumstances. If they had realized it was the king they would have helped, of course it would be crazy to ignore the king. But the king didn't look like they expected him to look. And this is the issue at hand. Is that God is not trying to develop followers who will simply put on their Sunday best outfits and play the part when they know God is looking. God is not looking for part-time disciples who serve when they think it will create a net benefit for them. God isn't teaching us to work the system and play the game and collect the pluses and reduce the minuses so that eventually our positive points will outnumber our negative points when everything is said and done. God is shaping us into the kinds of people who offer mercy and compassion, not as a strategic decision, as an overflow of our own changed lives. God is training us up to be the kind of people who respond in love whether anybody else is watching or not. He is training us up to be the kind of people who respond in compassion as a knee-jerk reaction. And it's going to take us some time to get there. It's a process. But he's training us into this. This is what God has always expected of his people. In fact, if you look back, you can find passages in the Hebrew Bible, in the Old Testament, where God has always been after this goal. There's a specific one in Isaiah 58 I wanted to show you. You could read this whole chapter and get an even better picture, but just a few verses. There's a time in the time of Isaiah, when the religious people, they were expecting God to be so impressed with their worship and their sacrifices, and God says, this is the kind of religion I want. Free those who are wrongly imprisoned. Lighten the burden of those who work for you. Let the oppressed go free. Remove the chains that bind people. Share your food with the hungry. Give shelter to the homeless. Give clothes to those who need them. Is this sounding familiar yet? I was hungry. I was thirsty. I was naked. I was in prison. God says, this is the kind of religion I want. Give clothes to those who need them. Do not hide from relatives who need your help. That's an interesting way to put that. And then, if you'll do that, if you will release the oppressed, care for the suffering, feed the hungry, give water to the thirsty, clothe the naked, visit the imprisoned and the sick, then your salvation will come like the dawn, and your wounds will quickly heal. And your godliness will lead you forward, and the glory of the Lord will protect you from behind. I think that's a pretty good description of what it means to be blessed. To be the kind of people who in this life, because we submit ourselves to the training and the instruction and the law of the Lord, who in this life accept the calling and the mission that God has given us to be people who show compassion and mercy and love quickly and generously and exuberantly. I think this description in verse 8 is what it looks like to be blessed in this life, because we joined in the mission of God. God is looking for disciples who are also looking. They're looking around for people to help and needs to meet and suffering to relieve. This morning, we're kicking off a sermon series that's going to take us through the month of January. But it's also the prequel, the precursor to this entire year's theme of my preaching, which is that we're going to focus on being good neighbors. We're going to focus together this year on hospitality. We're going to talk about becoming the kinds of friends and customers and citizens and strangers that the world is really thankful to have around. But it's important for me to say from the start that we're not just trying to be good neighbors to the people we already know and like. We're not just trying to be hospitable to Christians or people who act like us or think like us or live like us. We're not just trying to serve people who can do something for us. We're not trying to serve so that we can impress God. We're going to try to become good neighbors by allowing God to develop within us an earnest love for neighbors and strangers and even rivals around us. We're going to work on developing our hearts for the people that don't look anything like Jesus to us. Like, we don't see Jesus when we see them, but we're going to work on it. We're going to start training ourselves to see better because it presents an opportunity. You know, this church, we're in the habit of participating in so many service opportunities and mission projects and donation drives. And I'm thankful that we do every single one of those things. I'm thankful for the ways that we serve the community. But I think it's interesting that at least my own tendency is to kind of think every time we serve that way, every time we collect food, every time we give gifts, every time we do one of those mission projects, that we're being Jesus. This passage seems to indicate that when we do that stuff, we're meeting Jesus. When we do all of that stuff, we have a chance to encounter Jesus. And that reframes the entire narrative for me. And so we're going to work on changing our hearts this year so that helping and giving and serving and sharing are not just what we would do if we knew the boss was watching. It's what we do because the boss has trained us well. And I think that's what Jesus is referring to when he speaks about people who have been blessed already. People who have already spent so much time with the King that they've become the kinds of subjects he was looking for. And so I hope you'll join us for this journey this month and this year. Our hope is that during this time that we spend together, that each one of us would develop a deeper connection to God, to one another, and to purpose.